But more than anything, God loves admiration.
You saying God is vain?
No, not vain. Just wanting to share a good thing. I think it pisses God off if you walk by the color purple in a field and don't notice it.
Well, you saying it just want to be loved like it say in the Bible?
Yeah, silly. Everything want to be loved. Us sing and dance and holler. Just trying to be loved.
Welcome back to Adaptation Nation. It's a podcast where we read the thing, watch the thing, then talk about the thing. Today, we are talking about The Color Purple, Color Purple by Alice Walker, and the film directed by Steven Spielberg, on the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the publication of The Color Purple. And also, it's been the news of late as we're gearing up to have another film adaptation, this time bridging off of, taking inspiration from, or maybe more just a film adaptation of the musical that's based on The Color Purple called The Color Purple. And I think we can talk about why it's a interesting moment for this to happen in that particular format and what's left on the tree of The Color Purple for future adaptations, including this one. Join me today, Sharifa Williams, director of content here at Book Riot. And we were talking before we started recording, there is a lot here. This is the most about everything. And some of it is the work itself. Some of it is Alice Walker. Some of it is the movie. Some of it where this all happens in time and how we're looking back on it now. So Sharifa, thanks for joining me. I guess Let's start here. When you agreed to do this, what was at that moment your relationship to The Color Purple? When you you signed up to say, I'd be willing to talk about this one. What was your relationship to The Color Purple at that moment?
I had very vague recollections of the 1985 adaptation from watching it when I was very young. And I had never had the opportunity to read the book, which sounds shocking, perhaps, because it feels like one of those books everybody reads usually in school. And that just wasn't my story. I never got the opportunity to read it. So when I saw it there, not even realizing at the time that it was the 40th anniversary was coming up, I was just like, this is my opportunity to finally read one of those books that I have always felt a little bit weird about not having read.
Right.
And so now I can do it. And now I can like actually remember what the adaptation was about, because I did have the few memories of the adaptation I had were striking memories. And I couldn't remember if they were just living in my head or if they actually happened in the movie. So that's why I signed up for this.
And can you say what were the striking memories? Like, what was your mental model of the movie even coming into reading the book?
There were very visual. So I didn't remember a lot of the details of the actual story. Mm-hmm. I remembered Whoopi Goldberg's performance and Oprah's performance as well. Those two really stood out in my memory. But a lot of what I remembered about The Color Purple was, of course, that it was a book with high trauma, lots of violence and terrible things happening. And also just I had very specific, vivid images of scenes from the movie. And that's when I was like, did I make this up? Because it was striking. And I didn't know if it actually fit with the story. But now that I've watched it again, I realize that I understand now why I thought that they were like in my head. I had imagined these scenes, but actually they were in the movie itself.
I think that's important. I see in the notes here, you watched it when you were between 8 and 11 and probably on VHS or on television. I think this is important for people to remember. This is me coming off also having read The 90s by Chuck Klosterman recently. So I was just thinking about the structure of how we watched movies in the late 80s and early 90s, into the late 90s, right? Sharifa, you're younger than I am, but not by so much that you probably experienced was different than mine. I don't remember this movie ever playing on cable in my mind. And I think I understand why, right? For a lot of reasons, like how much you'd have to edit out, It's not like a great hang of a movie, frankly. You're not going to rewatch it a whole bunch of times, I don't think. I think probably racism is part of it as well, but there's so much of it that they would just have to edit out to play on TNT in 1994 or something like that. So probably on VHS, and it was hard to watch VHS. You had to rent it, and you wouldn't watch it over and over again. So a lot of these movies from this era, especially, I would say, unless my family owned them or I got a copy that we used a double tape player somewhere else to get one, like Empire Strikes Back or Back to the Future, something like that kids watched a bunch of times, you just wouldn't see this. And especially this relatively new designation of PG-13 was an 80s concoction of somewhere between PG and R. And it's a weird designation, right? My parents were fairly strict about what we watched. So I wasn't watching this till much later. I think I didn't watch this till after I'd read the book in college. So in the late 90s for me. So I didn't have the childhood memory of it as well. But as a black girl, I can only imagine this was a remarkable thing to encounter, right? You didn't have a lot of these. I mean, you didn't have a lot of these things to see. And in the culture, we had Roots, right? We had Roots, the movie, or the film and the book in 1977, and then The Color Purple, and the depictions of like TV, movies, film, primarily about black people. This was kind of it. I can't really think of anything else in the prestige culture landscape.
Yeah, this was very striking. I mean, in my family, it was definitely, there was definitely an effort to have us watch certain things. Like Roots, for instance, we had to sit down and watch when we were very young, and I didn't understand a lot of it at that time. But and The Color Purple was obviously the same. I didn't really understand a lot of it. But my parents were generally like, in my childhood, they weren't very restrictive about what we watched. I mean, we watched this like most of the Spike Lee movies in the theater.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, and they would just like have me cover my eyes for certain parts.
Amazing.
So it was to me, watching The Color Purple was part of that sort of like education. The education part of like growing up was very much happened around the TV. That was how we did it. And so it doesn't surprise me that that's how I came about just like exploring and seeing for the first time The Color Purple. It wasn't through a book, even though I was very bookish. But yeah, it was like seeing it now, I wish I could remember more about my thinking back then when I watched it, because I mean, there's a lot that's glossed over in the adaptation, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. But there are some elements there that, you know, are very specific and would inform a black girl in a certain way about what life was like and to kind of think about how life is today. And I just don't think I had the capacity at that time to really come up with a lot of obviously sophisticated, nuanced ideas.
Well, you're 9 years old, Sharifa. You can give yourself a break, I think.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm sure it impacted me in that, like, especially because I remember Whoopi Goldberg as Celie and the character of Celie so well. Yeah. Like, I just remember having a very visceral reaction to Celie as a character.
Yeah. That makes total sense. And I think, frankly, for the culture is maybe not too far off your own your mental index card of the movie The Color Purple. It's kind of been, it feels hazy, but also there's some weight there. And I think it is, this is introducing Whoopi Goldberg. This is, Oprah was a successful talk show host, but she's not the Oprah that we know, right?
No.
By any stretch of the imagination. And The Color Purple endures largely as a literary text, right? The movie has not overshadowed it for reasons that I think are understandable and enduring. But okay, so that's how we first encounter it. We're going to come back and talk a little bit about the book, its publication, and then get into the book itself. But take a quick break first.
Today's episode is brought to you by Mobius, part of Hachette Book Group. I have for you a swashbuckling fantasy that is full of demons, possible gods, ghosts, and an ornery mule. So Essevar Boros is one of the legendary sword-fighting magistrates known as the Great Coats and the king's personal investigator of the supernatural, and he is no stranger to tales of ghosts and demons. So when the fractious monks of the abbey, rumored to be the birthplace of the gods, begin warring over claims of a new pantheon arising, the frantic abbot summons him to settle the dispute. Armed only with his famed investigative talents, his faltering skill with a blade, and imperious, his ornery mule. In the words of Donkey from Shrek, though, he's a noble steed, okay? Armed with all those things, Essevar must root out the source of the madness lurking inside the once sacred walls of Isola Sombra before its chaos spreads to the country he's sworn to protect. Pick up Crucible of Chaos by Sebastian de Castile for all of the wonderful things I just described to you. I mean, it sounds like a good time. And thanks again to Mobius, part of Hachette Book Group, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode.
So The Color Purple comes out in 1982. Mm-hmm. It's not Alice Walker's first book. Alice Walker had been writing poetry at an editor in Ms. Magazine. Had written her debut novel was about her experience working, well, from her days at the NAACP. She worked for the NAACP for a while, but largely about freedom writers. And then 1982, The Color Purple comes out, and it's a sensation. She's the first Black woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for The Color Purple. She also wins the National Book Award for The Color Purple. Widely regarded, hugely celebrated, becomes a hot film property right away. We'll talk about that. I'm trying not to race ahead to the film stuff, but mm-hmm. I want to capture here that it was a phenomenon right away. Quincy Jones read it, got involved. Talking about Quincy's role in the movie is going to be fascinating here in a few minutes, but it was a thing in American culture, and especially, I want to say, among Black artists in intelligentsia. We have a new voice and something that is broken through into the American mainstream. And this happens a couple of times over the last 50 years. Mention Roots. By the way, side note, I was doing my research to try to put Color Purple in some context in Black books. The Roots sold 15 million copies in hardcover in its first 9 months in publication. I don't know how to contextualize that, Sharif, but that is an enormous number that is hard to wrap your head around. Almost as hard to wrap your head around Native Son, after being chosen by a selection for the Book of the Month Club in 1940, selling 500,000 copies in 3 months, which is a largely white person's subscription service for books,
yeah,
in 1940, which is even a radically more different racial thing. So and then before that, you're looking at the Harlem Renaissance, right? Where, mm-hmm. and that's only like 10 or 12 years before, where there's a huge upswell of mainstream, and let's be honest, when I say mainstream, I mean white people audience for Black arts, Black letters especially. So we get these punctuations. I think what's interesting about The Color Purple is it feels to me like the last one that feels like an aberration, that we go back to a higher baseline, if that makes sense. And some of it has to do with movies, some has to do with Black music, especially, you know, with hip hop and rap coming to be dominant, and then we get more Black people in movies, and then more Black stories get told again. Not nearly as many for a while as should be, and especially even now, but it was the last kind of singular text, which I think is really interesting. Alice Walker herself, I think she's a complicated person now, and we'll mention this briefly. We're not going to dwell on it too much here in a minute, but this was, at the time, a commercial, critical, and artistic success that's a little hard to remember now. I think interesting to think about where it happens in, you know, high literary culture. We get The Bluest Eye, I think, in 1973 for Tony, and then Beloved in 89. So he can cut. That's where I had it in my head, is right between those. Like, Beloved is the highest form of this, and then The Bluest Eye kind of got the ball rolling. But it feels to me that Color Purple really exists in that continuum as well. It's like more, it's a larger scope than The Bluest Eye, which is really centered on Pocola. And then Beloved has a much larger, grander artistic and historical vision. The Color Purple is very specific. It feels very insular, right? Because this epistolary format, you're really in Silly's head for most of it, and you get Nettie a little bit later. But it feels very much of a piece of a kind, and it feels like Morrison's transcendence over the years has kind of overshadowed The Color Purple in some way, even though more people could, I guess on a Q rating set, would recognize The Color Purple as a thing than any of Morrison's work. In a weird way, Morrison's total body work has now overshadowed The Color Purple, rightly or wrongly. Does that sound right at all to you, Sharifa? What would you say about that?
Yeah, I would say that's true. I think The Color Purple was like this singular pop cultural force as well as like a literary force.
Yes.
And I think that there are probably broader audiences who recognize The Color Purple because of the film adaptation and just because it was so much, there were so many people, so many icons of Black culture attached to that book, to that one specific book.
Yes.
That I think it just spread a lot more people's knowledge of the story. And even if they didn't watch the movie, or read the book, their just general knowledge of the story itself was there. It was present. So
yeah,
I would say it's got a pop culture element to it too.
Yeah, that's, and maybe even more enduring in a pop culture way than anything Morrison has done, or even Morrison herself. So there's this weird kind of, and again, it's not a competition really, but when you think about, in my own personal experience too, how large Morrison looms, but then The Color Purple itself has kind of a higher peak in awareness. And then Walker, her later, of late, let's just put it this way, of late her comments and some of the stuff she said in public has been at the least bad, head-scratching, and at the worst part, kind of disturbing, about some books that she's recommended in public that are conspiracy theories, anti-Semitic in some ways, but it's not quite that simple, but also like an L. Ron Hubbard sort of, there are lizard people that rule everything that she recommends in public and talks about reading. You can Google this stuff. We're not going to dwell on it here, but I think it goes into the pot of how Alice Walker is now, The Color Purple now is bigger than Alice Walker, and she doesn't have another book that people know. And I think I read some essays later. She's also well known for rehabilitating, resuscitating, rejuvenated the legacy of Zora Neale Hurston, In Search of Our Mother's Gardens, famously in 1975. So I think really The Color Purple and then the resuscitation of Hurston, and in a lot of ways, I think Their Eyes Are Watching God in a curricular way has taken over the place that may have been occupied by The Color Purple. It's not quite as explicit, Sharifa. I think it's just, it's more high school friendly than The Color Purple is. So there's not too many syllabus slots, and I think that's something that's happened over time. But you know, it was a huge phenomenon right away. It sold a lot of copies, very critically acclaimed. I guess in our reading of it, your first reading, and it might as well, it feels like it might as well have been my first reading, because I think it's been 25 years, to be honest with you. But what was it like to read The Color Purple?
It was really, I had forgotten how emotional, how heart-wrenching and heartbreaking that story is. But also, I found it really profound how much Alice Walker was able to fit of Seeley's life and the life of this whole community of people who make up Seeley's world, how much of their lives she was able to fit into this story, and how complex she was able to make their arcs. Yeah. They grew and developed in so many unexpected ways. I kind of remembered, as I mentioned, a lot about Celie being this big, important character for me, but I had forgotten about how big and deep and wonderful this huge cast of characters was until I read the book itself. So I just found that it was definitely well worth the time. I'm really glad that I made it a priority for reasons of doing this podcast. And I was hugely impacted by reading it as an adult.
We were talking a little bit on Friday as part of a different call about our experience of it. And so we're starting to do the pod but without recording. And one of the things that we agreed or came to, I think we found some consensus around, is that it holds up and it feels contemporary still. I mean, it's historical fiction of the time, and historical fiction can endure a little bit better because it's already looking backwards, right? So it doesn't feel, it's kind of like folk music. It doesn't ever feel of the time, but it's never sort of out of time. I think that's like a Bob Dylan quote. I might be paraphrasing there. Sorry, Bobby. So for those of you who haven't read the book that know the movie or just have a general maybe hazy purple-hued sense of the cultural object that is the color purple, it's written, it's an epistolary novel. And to my mind, I think it might be the best one ever written, that at least that I've ever read. Let's put it that way. I haven't read them all, I'm sure. But it's Celie, who's a 15-year-old child bride with, let's say, a complicated lineage, which we kind of can't get into here because it's hard to trace, having children by who she thinks is her biological father at the time. And really the inciting incident of the book is those children being taken from her, you know, one after the other. I think we start, the present tense of the first entry is her second child being born, right, Sharifa? And that's Olivia being taken away?
Yeah, when Olivia is taken away, and then we learn about Adam as well having been taken away. Yeah. And those scenes, like the original, the moment when we learn that, you know, Celie's kids are taken away, those are like really short but powerful scenes of just like, this is a huge moment in Celie's life that was horrible and carries through in the book in a really significant way.
And there's an experience of reading The Color Purple, especially the early chapters, that is kind of like reading Morrison, and also, you know, in a telescopic way, like reading Faulkner, where you're not really sure what's happening.
Yeah.
Like you know, Walker is writing, Celie writing to herself. So she doesn't explain herself the details, right? She's not saying, well, this is what happened. She's going through it. And I think we learned that she started... do we believe that these are actually paper documents? I guess that was one of my big questions for you, is like, is she actually writing these down on paper somewhere and putting them in a box? That's never clear to me. And the movie doesn't... The way the movie deals with the letters is something to talk about. But let's say it's not resolved there. I'm not actually sure what we're supposed to be understanding about what these documents are. Are they in her head? If they're in her head, then why is the spelling different? I mean, I know Walker's trying to capture Celie's 15-year-old, not without much education, but it's a little unclear to me, like, what the meta-textual scene we're in here. Is she finding time to write these? I don't know if it matters, but I was pretty interested by it. Do you have a sense of it, Sharifa?
Yeah, you know what? I imagined in this moment when I was reading the book that it was like a sort of almost nighttime prayer Celie was having.
Yeah, so that's how it feels.
Yeah, it was. I thought of it as in her head. And there's actually like a sort of, I don't think it's a speculative note about this upcoming newer adaptation that sort of emphasized that maybe I was correct in my reading of that, in that they're going to incorporate some elements of magical realism so that you can get into Celie's head in the way you do in the book itself. So I definitely thought of this as, especially when Celie is recounting her younger years, because the thing about Celie is that there's so much she doesn't know, and there are some clever scenes in the 1985 adaptation where she's like learning a lot, like with reading and stuff.
Yeah. And it's a great scene, actually. It was one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
I think anybody who loves language and words in general loves that scene. And so I think that because of Celie's understanding of the world and her ability to be able to write in the first place early on. I just sort of assumed that it was in her head.
Yeah. And it kind of doesn't matter. And it wouldn't have struck me until later in the book. So she and her sister get separated early, Nettie. And in my, I guess I kind of stepped over this earlier. My mental model of the book was, this was Shug and Seeley's story. And I think it still is, but it's not only that. And you were saying this as well about how actually the community and what Walker's able to do through the prism of Celia's journals and capturing, following, explaining, loving this community that has so many problems and does such horrible things to each other and has such horrible things done to it is really a wonder. But I didn't remember that really the central, in a lot of ways, the central trauma of many traumas in Celia's life, as she sees it, is being separated from Nettie. And not only being separated from her, but not knowing that she's gone, or not knowing what happened to her. And then not knowing that for decades, her forced, arranged husband has been keeping these letters, and she could have had these letters to sustain her throughout. Even more than the physical trauma she bears, that's the moment in the book where she almost takes a straight razor to Albert. Like, that's the thing that does it, is the severing of this connection. And again, there's a lot else that goes into it, but that's the inciting moment. And those are presented as real letters, right? And we get those directly.
Yeah.
So then it made me wonder, okay, then what does that say about the relationship of these other letters we're seeing? I think maybe it's an interesting unknown at this point, like where and if those things are happening in the real world outside of Seeley's mind and what they're doing for her. Yeah, I think similarly, the feeling I had of reading, especially the first half as you get into, is how the book really blossoms out of the early chapters, out of these very, very difficult, terrible scenes, and how they show Seeley working in the world and trying to connect with other people and having her own time connecting, and she herself doing some very difficult things that are hurtful, and then both giving and receiving forgiveness over time in ways that are sometimes hard to believe emotionally, or hard to, not believe is the wrong word, but seem almost like superhuman. That's the kind of grace that some of the people give each other.
Mm-hmm.
But also feels very human at the same time. I was blown. I have to say I was overwhelmed at moments by it, and it was better than I remember. And I don't know what that says about my memory, but that's my experience of it as well. You have some notes here in terms of how Walker came to this particular book. And I have some overlapping ones. It could be, if you want to do further reading, we'll put links in the show notes. But Walker studied Africa herself and studied abroad in Africa. And we get some stories from Africa. Nettie becomes a missionary in Africa. And that comes in, too, where she's trying to connect pieces of the American trans-African experience and inheritance and loss and generations and things go into it. But then also she was, Walker herself was talking to sharecroppers and writing poetry. And then she was seeing some of her own extended families in those stories and realized there weren't books like that. There just weren't these community-based stories of the rural South, especially. We get some different ones in the Harlem Renaissance and Living is Easy, Dorothy West, the simple short story Langston Hughes, but in terms of these rural people, sharecroppers, there wasn't a depiction of how life was. And I think that's another thing, especially the movie that also blew me away. The production design of the sense of place is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
The movie is incredibly gorgeous, and the production design is amazing, and the costuming and the architecture and everything really was striking. And that's something that we hadn't really seen before. Walker grew up in Eatonton, Georgia. And then this is supposed to also be set in Georgia, though filmed largely in, well, your neck of the woods now, Sharifa.
Yeah,
North
Carolina,
it looks like. So that's another striking thing about it. But the decision to use Seeley, this withdrawn, traumatized, I think it's fair to say broken thing at the beginning, Sharifa.
Yeah.
And the story of The Color Purple is the rehabilitation of Seeley, right? Is there a, that's not the worst way to think about it, is it?
I don't think it is. And I think, like, between the, you know, Seeley either writing or thinking her notes to God aloud, and then some of the interaction she has, specifically with one scene between her and Sophie that I'm thinking about. Like, there are some rehabilitation moments of, like, just dealing with who she addresses in her,
yes,
we'll call them letters, in her letters, and who she's addressing those letters to, and her relationship with the version of God she sees, and how that is also a moment of her changing her perspective on, you know, this omniscient white male God with a, you know, white beard and everything's white. And then also, yes, there's this one moment with Sophie as well, Sophia, where she tells Harpo to beat her. And
yeah,
that was the first moment I knew, you know, there were all sorts of terrible things happening that were inflicted upon Celie by other characters. But there are moments where we see that, you know, there are real negative impacts on Celie herself and how she handles her relationships with people and inflicts pain on people because it's all she knows, you know, and she thinks, yeah, that's just the way of the world. And then, you know, being forgiven for that, even though it caused, yeah, some real strife. I think that a rehabilitation story is a good way, mm-hmm, to look at that for numerous reasons.
Yeah, I think that moment is, I don't know, maybe the bottom of Celie's agency, right? When, mm-hmm, she parrots what she's been told and seen into the world and makes it worse. And we see a lot of cases, like one of the criticisms of the book when it was initially published, and it looks like maybe is continued to this day, about, let's just call it, it's a tough look for Black men on the whole,
yeah,
in The Color Purple. And, you know, I don't really feel qualified or interested in getting on one side or other of that argument. But I think if you read the book, you can see how Black men aren't the focus of this, but inherited trauma, inherited cycles are on the table as well. You know, Mr. learned stuff from his dad. And, yeah, the other thing, this book starts in 1909. We're 44 years from slavery, right? I'm nowhere in this book. Let's put it, I'm not, this is not my timeline. But like when we're reading this, the book is set, like these people's parents, Celie's parents and grandparents were slaves.
Yeah.
Or had aunts and uncles were slaves. So this is a broken, not even broken, a captive, hostage, enslaved community 1.5 generations after emancipation. It makes sense that there's brokenness all around, right? There's a certain sense of how could it be any different, right? How could it have been? There's no help here. There's white people in this book, but they are, you know, distant forces. They're all powerful. And one character, Sophie, goes to jail for 12 years for just talking back to the mayor's wife. And the movie can't handle that. They make Sophie hit her, which I thought was an interesting choice. But in the book, if I'm remembering it right, she just talks back to her. And that's how huge, godlike a presence the white supremacists and individual white people were in this. And this whole Black community is living under that, right? And that's how they see relationships and power and dominance to work, how social structure should be organized, or is at least organized. And it trickles all the way down to how you raise your kids and how they talk to their friends. And so I think a systemic trauma is maybe a different way of understanding it, rather what individual people do, but that what individual people do here in relationship to it is fascinating. And then I think Walker positioning Shug Avery, I was talking to Michelle about this morning. She had a vague memory of it as well. She's like, well, how was it? And what stuck out to you? She's like, the singular character, or almost like, I don't even call it creation, insight, creative drive, is Shug becomes the locus of a lot of healing, interestingly, in the book,
mm-hmm,
an outcast, a maybe prostitute, maybe not, certainly singing in juke joints when, you know, not participating in society as her parents would want, as her would-be suitors would want, other people want. But she's the person around with a lot of this reconstitution or reimagining how relationship could be happens. And that's about art. that's about relationship, and that's about freedom. And she's the nexus for all kinds of freedoms, whether it's sexual, whether it's attitudinal, monetary. That was the thing that stuck out to me, that Suge is the fulcrum around which whatever happens in this book happens. What do you make of the character of Suge Avery on your read as an adult, Shreva?
I think that my feelings about Suge Avery kind of encapsulate a lot of my feelings about this story, is that I feel like there's a lot of radical thought that happens in this book. And I think one of the striking things about Suge Avery, as I read The Color Purple and fretted over these characters worrying for their future, because I couldn't remember how it all ended, which was terrifying.
Yeah, right. Me too. I couldn't either. That's a great, I didn't realize that, but you're totally right. There was a plot anxiety that I was feeling. Good point.
And one of the things that struck me as being especially radical is that a character like Suge Avery doesn't meet some sort of tragic end in this story, because she just lives her life in this, in a way that's even freer than I could imagine. Like, she just does not care about what anybody's thinking. There are moments, of course, she's as capable of vulnerability. She's a human being. She feels things and she hurts and everything else, but she's really committed to just being herself and living life by this philosophy that I thought was really beautiful, that she talks about a little. I mean, it's sort of the reason the book is named The Color Purple, when she's talking with Celie, and just learning about her philosophy of life and just seeing how she lives in this world that is very much against her. She's a black queer woman, and she has her own money. She's doing her own thing, and that she did not have to be, you know, martyred in this story.
Yeah.
Like, that sort of made me, in a way I probably couldn't have before, celebrate this character, Suge Avery, in the story. She was just probably, other than Celie, the most striking character in the book for me.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're opposites, right? Where at the beginning, Suge is, at the beginning, she comes to the story in the back of a wagon. We're not really sure what disease she has. I can't tell. She has tuberculosis or something? It doesn't really matter. But she's brought low by some malady and nursed back to health, largely by Celie. But we learn that Celie's husband, Albert, wanted to marry Suge. His father wouldn't allow it. And it's not really clear what that looks like. Maybe he wouldn't have inherited the farm or got money. His family looks like it comes from, relatively speaking, good condition. And a lot, if not all of Albert's, I don't know what, behavior comes out of not living the life he wanted to live. And that's another thing that revolves around Suge. And he comes to, frankly, some kind of understanding with Suge and Celie and Suge's later paramour, Grady, that there's another way of being connected to people. It doesn't have to be about ownership or exclusivity. And that not only is black sexuality and art and liberation not a threat, but also it's a way out, right? I mean, Suge uses the very things people don't like about her to buy a giant home in Memphis and be independently wealthy and get with 19-year-olds later in the book when she's feeling like that's what she wants to do. Go, Suge. And then, the line to me that stuck out, and I'm sad it's not in the movie, because I think to me it was a key to my understanding of why I found it so moving, is Celie at one point says about Suge, she understands how to love somebody. And that line alone, I think, made me realize that the characters in the book don't know how to love each other. They don't have models for it. They don't have agency to do it. They're under such duress that the kinds of love that they would like to get and would like to give, frankly, they don't have models for, and Suge gives it to them. It's without judgment. It's without ownership. It's without, I guess those two, it's without violence, and without subjectivity to any, as much as was possible, moral or legal authority. It existed out, her liberation existed outside of that. Now it's in marginal spaces of juke joints and brothels and those kinds of places, but there's a crack there to find a way to live in the world. And once Celie had to learns how to love differently, once Harpo does, once Sophie does, a lot of things start opening up in ways that are pretty remarkable too. All right. You said the best thing about Celie's voice. Yeah, I said Shug. I think the actual epistolary form does it a lot of service. We don't know too much about Celie's thoughts, but we know enough. Like there's an access yet wall between her and Intuit Order. So it doesn't suggest we get to know everything, but we know enough. And we get to see her learn and grow over time. Anything that didn't work for you or anything that you bumped on as you're reading this, Sharif? I see a couple notes here and I'd like to hear about them.
Yeah, I really did not have a lot of bad things to say about this book because it just struck me as this powerful force I was glad to be exposed to. And I think that it was just the knowledge of, you know, and this is sort of why it took me a long time to get to reading this book, is because a lot of these sort of canonical books of African-American fiction usually are trauma stories that are not easy to read, but, you know, you have to get through. And it's just the knowledge that these things that are happening in this fictional world are actual reality. Like, this is what the world looked like for African Americans of the time, and the complex, you know, dynamics that Alice Walker really gets into in this story, this was the community you had, and this is the this is how you survive, is through your community. And so there are all sorts of ways you have to navigate that, even though oppression can come from many places. And just to, you know, that reminder was the hardest thing, I would say, I guess, about reading this book.
Yeah, I think that's not an artistic flaw, anything. It just makes it hard. And you're right. I think that's kind of why the movie doesn't probably show up on cable, right?
Yeah.
You don't really want to spend time in the book. I mean, as beautiful and as moving as it is, it's not a rewatch kind of a situation, generally speaking. I was thinking about that too. It's like, you know, the movies that come a little bit later, you know, Spielberg takes another crack at telling a story about black people and black slavery with Amistad, and it doesn't really work as well either. And it takes a while for things to get picked up. And I think that's why I want to move to talk about the movie a little bit, because there's a lot of stuff that we could talk about there. Yeah. My only, I'm not sure, I guess it's more of not how it's not good. I wasn't sure exactly how to deal with how the back, really third of the book is reading Nettie's letters and this whole sub story, the B plot. I don't know if it's a B. I don't know how you can hear me struggle with it a little bit, Sharif. Like, what to do with? We get a lot of that, a whole lot of it.
Yes.
And I don't have a great interpretive handle on what to do with it. I think Walker is trying to expand Celie's vision, right? And expand this. There's a whole experience of blackness. And it's not just this one community. And Celie actually, I think, is buttressed by the idea that her sister is out in the world seeing big things, you know, in Africa. She says, my sister's in Africa. She kind of can't believe it. But then we get sort of very, very detailed descriptions of the Yoinka's relationship to the British rulers and a road being built. And it feels like a diversion from what we have been expecting. And I'm not exactly sure how it pays off in the end, but that's the one place where my brain keeps trying to float back to say, what is going on with that? And how does it connect with what's going on? So I don't know. Can you fix me, Sharifa? Did you have an interpretive model that I can steal from you?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's helpful. I think that as I was reading it, and especially as I was realizing that, you know, Walker herself had gone to Africa, in my mind, I was just wondering if this was just stuff that was front of mind for her, or stuff she had never really gotten to write about in any sort of way, and wanted Nettie to be an opportunity to do that, because I know she had She had done some activism as well around, you know, female mutilation in Africa, which is also discussed in the story. And in the other books, she expands that story. So it's not like it was a sort of drop in the pan for her. The Africa part of the story and the characters continue on in the other books, which I have definitely never read as well. But
yeah, me neither. Yeah. That's a great point that some of these stories continue. And I don't want to... I actually found the story, the idea of stories about Black missionaries in Africa to be fascinating. It wasn't, they were interesting passages as well, but it was, and then weirdly, the most like sort of meta moment was Nnedi's letter to Seeley, in which he was telling the story of other missionaries. It's like, whoa, really having some vertigo here about what's going on. But she was in, and so it wasn't bad necessarily. It felt, I feel a little more... Not interested. That's where my unknowing is drifting to at this
took
point.
Took you out of the story a little bit?
I don't know. It's just like I kept wanting to go back to Seeley's story. Like you said, what happens to Seeley? What happens to Shug? And I would catch myself zipping ahead over the... I was like, okay, I get it. There's stuff happening. It's interesting, but I want to get back to the people we've been following for 200 pages already. So that's maybe more my problem than the text. All right, we're going to do another break and wrestle with the movie.
Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle. Walk, Ride, Paddle is a captivating memoir of Senator Tim Kaine's physical journey through the Virginia wilderness, but it is also a unique and ultimately optimistic perspective on these pivotal moments in history, offering inspiration, wisdom, and hope. With immediacy and honesty, Kaine pulls back the curtain to reveal his inner thoughts during such monumental times. And Kaine's storytelling gift and wise observations offer a fascinating glimpse into the mind of a seasoned politician and outdoor enthusiast. Walk, Ride, Paddle is available everywhere audiobooks are sold on April 9th. It is narrated and written by Tim Kaine, Virginia Senator and former Democratic vice presidential candidate. It's a compelling account of one man's journey across hundreds of miles of Virginia wilderness and a moving testament to the optimistic spirit of America. So make sure to check out Walk, Ride, Paddle by Tim Kaine. And thanks again to Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by W.W. Norton & Company Incorporated. So, Negative Space by Jillian Linden follows a week in the life of an English teacher at a New York private school. At home, her children ask constant questions about mortality, and her husband offers occasional counsel between Zoom calls. At school, something happens. She accidentally witnesses an ambiguous, possibly inappropriate interaction between a teacher and a student, but how can she be sure of what she saw? Negative Space is a portrait of a woman caught between the pressures of what's normal and what isn't, and examines what we owe the people who depend on us in a fractured and indifferent world. It's a debut novel and a short novel. It's perfect if you want something quick and easy to carry around, but it's also thought-provoking. It takes place during the pandemic, but it's not pandemic-focused, and it really just looks at everyday anxieties in low-threat situations that have high consequences. So make sure to check out Negative Space by Jillian Linden. And thanks again to W.W. Norton & Company Incorporated for sponsoring this episode.
Like I said, this became a hot property. And it seems to me largely motivated, expedited by one Mr. Quincy Jones, who was... was interested in promoting Oprah's career, interested in Black arts in general, had been in the movie and music business. I mean, if I have to tell you who Quincy Jones is, I don't know how to help you, but let's just say, if you don't, that he is a mover and shaker in Hollywood and the recording industry, you know, going back to his days as a jazz trumpet player, all the way through really until very recently when he's an older guy now, but wanted this to happen. And he approached Spielberg, apparently, about making this movie. Mm-hmm. And Spielberg, I think to his credit, said, I don't know, man. You know, Spielberg's a blockbuster director. This is really his first non-Jaws, you know, kind of Indiana Jones, E.T. movie. He's like, I don't know if I can handle this. Am I the right person to do this? And Quincy said something to him very interesting. I think it says something about the early 80s, which is you're the only one that can. Like, you know, I can't get this made with anybody else, right? This is not a story that's going to get a big budget, that Hollywood producers aren't going to get behind. I need to really attach this to someone like you to get the movie made in the way that should be made, which is practical, understandable, and both sad. I mean, that's ultimately sad. I mean, the thing, people, we look at this now and say, why doesn't a black director make this? If you needed a big name director to make this movie, to get the funding, you didn't have a place to go, really, Sharifa. You and I were talking about this a little bit before. There is no, Spike Lee's coming a little bit late. He's got one independent movie in his belt, right? Mm-hmm. We're still 6 years from Do the Right Thing. We're 2 years from She's Gotta Have It. And this is the cultural deficit that's still taken us some while we'd have better choices now, with more choices. And it wouldn't happen this way, but that's how it happened. And I think that overshadowed, I think, some of the movie itself was that Spielberg was involved. I don't know that he does it pretty well or not. It's hard to know. It feels a little bit like a museum piece to me that all the movie, I'm not sure what your experience is like it, but nominated for 10 Academy Awards. Let me get some of this back stuff out of the way before we get into it. Notably, it is tied for the record with most Academy Award nominations and not win one, mm-hmm. with the turning point in 1977. 10 nominations, no victories, which, I mean, at some level you're like, boy, that seems real bad. And also, like, in the 80s, stupidly and painfully, not all that surprising. I think the one category that was especially tough was both Margaret Avery and Oprah were nominated Best Supporting Actress. And maybe this sometimes happens with movies like this. They split the vote. If someone wants to vote for The Color Purple, 50 go to one and someone else ends up winning. Mm. Just a fascinating to see what happened to screenplay. So Alice Walker was initially skeptical, as you might imagine, of Hollywood taking on this story. She made an agreement where she'd get a first crack at the screenplay. She also saw E.T. and thought it was really good and thought that Spielberg portrayed E.T. as a person of color, as being other, which I thought was an interesting and weird comment at the same time, which I don't think we need another 2 hours to unpack something like that. It did very well at the box office. Critical reviews were generally very strong. Let's see. I mean, we could do casting. I mean, you did some of the, why don't you lead with your interesting, what factoids do we want to bring in, either as interesting of their own as possibly meaningful for how this thing was cast and brought into production?
I went down a whole IMDb rabbit hole because, yes, of course, when you have a big movie like this that has become very, you know, memorable in the history of filmmaking, they will always have a million trivia points. And I was specifically looking for this part because I was curious about why exactly it was decided to leave out some of the, you know, the actual sapphic romance story between Seeley and Shug. And it does sound like Steven Spielberg does consider it a mistake that he did not portray that relationship. So I just really wanted to know and to get down to the bottom of that. Like, was it because it was cut out or like ended up on the editing room floor or, but it was exactly what you would think it was. He thought that it would alienate audiences. It's unfortunate. Yeah. But yeah, there were other like just really interesting factoids. I was wondering about the casting of Shug specifically. I didn't know Margaret Avery too well, and it sounds either. Like a yeah. few people had gone through, were potentials, like Tina Turner turned down the role. I did not realize that. I'm trying to imagine Tina Turner as Shug Avery, and she has. Well,
yeah, it sounds like they went through like famous black performers.
Yes.
Black women performers and said, can we, who else? I saw Chaka Khan was on there. Patti LaBelle.
Chaka Khan could not. She didn't think she could do it. So she decided. And yeah,
it's so interesting now that I think the tables have turned where if Color Purple came out today as a book and got turned into a movie, the Jennifer Hudsons, the Beyoncés of the world would be beating the door down. Like this would be the most hotly contested part to get, right? Because you don't have to carry the whole movie. You come in and you're just a fireball. You get the most interesting lines, you get to everything else. But they, you know, Chaka Khan said she was just nervous. She didn't know if she could do it and what would happen. I think it was reasonable in 1982. Very, very understandable to be nervous about it, right?
That's not a small character to portray. That's a tough one.
And who knows what script you got, as you said. Was there a scene where they're holding mirrors up to Celie's underparts like there are in a book? What is happening right here exactly? What am I doing, Steve? Help me understand. I can understand that. I saw the same thing. I found that comment of Spielberg about his biggest regret about is not giving more screen time and explicitness to the romance, the sexual relationship between Celie and Shug. Maybe it's me and my memory of the early 80s would be like the scene they are kissing and making out. Mm-hmm. I think that's all mainstream movies were going to do in 1985. I just don't know where else I don't know if that is making an excuse or something, but like for a big tentpole movie with giant stars that you want to be seen by hundreds of millions or tens of millions of people, I don't know the world was ready. And that's why books can be ahead of this stuff, because it doesn't need a $100 million budget. And maybe that's a critique of Hollywood. That's fine. But I just don't see a world where some other director is like, you know what? We really need a lot more like explicit sex scenes between these two black women. And that's going to go great in 1985. Again, an indictment of the time. And I think one of the reasons there's meat on the bone for musical adaptations, other things to do, because there's a different appetite now. You look at something like, I was thinking, the thing in my mind as I was watching this was the Underground Railroad adaptation adapted by Barry Jenkins, which gets the budget, the artistic freedom, the cultural moment in which topics and explicitness and depictions, either anticipatory or real, of having nervousness about what the audience, and let's be honest, we're talking about white people here, is going to handle, is just different. So you could do different things. I don't know. It's hard to know how that would be. And also this PG-13 idea. If it's rated R, he's had some experience with PG-13 Indiana Jones, right? These are giant movies. And this one, if it's rated R, it makes half as much money.
Yeah.
And these are commercial products. So there's something to be said there. I think for me, in terms of the culture, this is the Whoopi and Oprah show, right? If there's like a two-sentence thing about what The Color Purple meant as a movie, it's that we got Whoopi Goldberg and Oprah's in it.
Yeah,
I think that's it, pretty much.
Yeah, those are the two.
Should we talk about Whoopi and Oprah here? What do you want to say about Whoopi and Oprah in this movie?
I still can't remember another performance of Oprah's. I will say that I am not like, I have not watched all of Oprah Winfrey's film catalog, but I cannot remember one as powerful as Oprah in The Color Purple. And Whoopi,
she's great. She is really great in the first half of the movie, especially.
She is amazing because that is also a character. Sophia is she's a tough character, and she's another larger than life personality. And Oprah is such a different person in this role that I almost don't think of her as Oprah when I watch the movie.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And I know it's her there, but as I was watching the movie, it sort of slipped away. She was this character. And that was like, that really told me something. And Oprah, I learned also in my rabbit hole, she sort of ad-libbed that whole scene where they're at the dinner table, where she, finally comes through out of this fog that was caused by this terrible incident she had with the mayor and his wife. And I was kind of blown away by that. And also that that Whoopi Goldberg, I have always seen as a comedic actress. That she could, like, this role, her as Celie, is also completely outside of what I would expect from Whoopi Goldberg. Because she's just, again, a completely different person as this character. Right. I think it just spoke to their ability to act in this movie.
Yeah. They're both about 5 years away from super, super stardom. Like Whoopi, and peak Whoopi is like, Live Aid on stage with Robin Williams and doing Sister Act and, stuff like that. And then Oprah really in the late 80s, and into the early 90s, peak Oprah is still a ways away. I'm so used to, I'm like you, I'm like Whoopi now, has been for like 30 years the mini dreadlocked John Lennon bespectacled version of Whoopi. She is like a fairly safe, I mean, she's on The View for God's sakes. I mean, what is safer, more mainstream position than that? But Here, she's wonderful. Her comedy in these mid-80s to late-80s is really transgressive. She got cast off a comedy club stage, essentially. Apparently turning Spielberg around by doing an impression of E.T., being pulled so over weird. For a pot bust is how he... I wish there was a YouTube video of this, Sharifa.
I saw that and I was like, do I need to fact check this? Because that just sounds completely unlikely and preposterous. Like, how does this
Which
happen?
Almost means it has to be true, right? Yeah. You can't make that kind of stuff up. So that, I guess the other note, and as we get, the big question mark for me is, and I did a reread of the book before rewatching the movie. And I was like, I don't remember how they did Mr. Albert or Mr. Johnson, or like, it's a little clear how Celia, and Danny Glover plays Albert, and Danny Glover is not yet Danny Glover. Like, he's still a few years away from Lethal Weapon. He'd come off supporting roles in Witness and, it's like a Western. I can't remember the name of it right now. It's a Lawrence Kasdan Western. It's pretty famous. Oh, it's on the tip of my tongue. Doesn't matter. but I think it's an impossible play. It's an impossible part to play. And Glover is too likable to play it. That's kind of where I'm coming down. I feel like a lot of what rubbed me the wrong way about the movie had to do with Albert. And some of it is, I don't know it's playable in a way that, I don't know. That's where I came. That was the only place where I'm like, is there somebody else they could have gotten? And maybe it's my own, you know, mid-40s affection for the post-Royal Tenenbaums, Lethal Weapon, you know, congenial, funny, physically gifted. I mean, his best part's in Color Purple is when he gets to be goofy, weirdly, which is also tonally strange. That was the one. That was the only, everything else, Margaret Avery's amazing. The characters, you know, all of them up and down the line, there's just a murderer's row of people who are great. And Glover is the one, like, A, I don't know how you do this, and B, I certainly don't know how you do it if it's Danny Glover. Am I on the right wavelength, or how did you respond to Glover as Mr. Albert here?
I was shocked. Not shocked, because I knew he was in it, but I didn't picture, when I was reading the book and not really thinking about the movie, I didn't picture somebody like Danny Glover as Mr. or Albert. Like, I definitely pictured Albert as more of a, you know, like, you could see his weakness in his physicality, and like, Danny Glover does seem a little too, like, he just doesn't fit that internal personality of Albert that I pictured. He seems a little bit too strong and too, like, leading man type character. So
that's right. That's what it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Shug's big critique of Albert is he's too weak, right? He's too weak. I couldn't be with him, even though I love him. And you look at Glover, he's got this wonderful smile. He's a big, tall, handsome guy. There's one scene where he's looking around for his clothes without a shirt on, and the dude is shredded.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's not right. That's not right.
And he was
that's
definitely
right. I think that physicality is part of it too.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I get that as well.
So I don't know. I mean, I don't know enough about what available black actors were working in 1983, 84, 85. I'm not going to do it in a recasting position, but I think it also speaks to tonally the movie at some points is much more comedic and broad than the book ever is. And some of that's because you can see it. And I think it's a dramedy, right, in places where the book is not a dramedy. It's just not. And I think that's the one place where, and maybe it's Spielberg not knowing how tonally to handle it. I think post-jail Sophie is a bit of a tough hang before she gets to that speech, where trying to depict a woman who is traumatized but not gone, I'm not sure what direction they gave Oprah, but it's very like, I don't know, she's kind of rocking to herself. They gave her some prosthetic eye damage. Just seemed a little too much on the whole. But I will say I found it very moving still. Goldberg is great. Margaret Avery is great. The production design is great. And I enjoyed the movie. I think it's a good movie, not a great movie. Sharifa, where do you come down on this sort of subjective classification?
I agree. I think overall, like, I definitely felt there was at the very least a softening of the edges in the adaptation. I did not want to relive some of the worst scenes or the most terrifying scenes of the story, but I felt like I could. It was very obvious to me that a lot of that stuff was left out, and there was a bit more of a, you know, happy-go-lucky spirit in places where I don't think it was really necessary. But there were also, I think that the moments that really saved the movie for me, of course the casting, but I think that the really emotionally charged moments of all of the moments in that movie, the separation of Celie and Nettie was like a punch to the heart. Like, there was no softening there. That was like the hardest moment to watch for me, or the hardest scene. So overall, I felt like a lot of the impact of the book was lost in the retelling. But there were some, you know, there were some really powerful scenes, and there was some amazing acting, and the cinematography, like you said, was really exceptional. Like, I understand now why, like, the visual elements of that movie really stuck with me so many years after watching it the first time, because, you know, even some of the scenes from Africa, which were kind of throwaway, but the visual elements of those scenes from Africa with Nettie, where she's recounting her story, were like, they would have appealed to my childhood mind.
There's some stuff that Spielberg does that actually is additive. I think that scene where I keep referring to him as Paul D, because Danny Glover plays Paul D in Beloved, and it's a homologous character. No, when Albert forces Nettie off, that's one place where his physicality, the Mr. Albert of the book, is not clear how that happened. They change that a little bit. I think Nettie more runs away than is forced away, because she's about to be the subject of, frankly, serial rape over time, and she gets away from that. But Glover's physicality there makes that possible. The Mr. Albert of the book could not physically make Celie and Nettie, like, get over the fence post, so to speak. But there's a couple places, like the hand games between Nettie and Celia, are a wonderful shorthand for their connection, right? That's one of those things that film does better. You get them singing in their hand games. There's also a scene where they're talking. Nettie has come to stay with Celia after Celia's been forced to go marry. The normal words don't apply. She's not really forced, and yet she's forced. Her dad isn't. It is what it is. But then Nettie comes to visit, and she's surviving by having Nettie around, and they're talking. And Spielberg is just shooting their shadows on the wall as they're talking and playing the hand games and hugging. It's just a really beautiful, tender stuff. I'm like, oh, Spielberg, turns out, knows how to direct a movie if he gets a chance to do some. But then the hand games too, and then at the end they play the hand games. Apparently Walker's least favorite part was the opening, right? Did you see the same anecdote?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, take it away from there.
What did she say? It was like Oklahoma? Is that what she compared
Oklahoma, it? Oh, What a Beautiful Morning, I think, is what she means, that opening song from Oklahoma.
And it's so funny, because I read that and I was like, oh, I kind of liked that moment for me. And of course, she did see how audiences reacted to that moment and was like, okay, fine. But she definitely, that's when I read that she thinks of the movie as being a very different thing than the book. So that was how she was able to accept it, even though she had her disagreements with how it was done. But that was funny to me.
And I think that very different thing is probably the right way to think about this. And the thing that's lost is related to form. And I think it's also related to what you, and I agree, is the central strength of the book, which is the cultivation and articulation of Celie's interior in the form of the letters. Hard to do in movie unless it's all going to be voiceover, right? We just lose the letters. Like, there's little snippets of voiceover, but it's not enough to replicate it. And so a lot of it is just having to look at Whoopi's eyes reacting to stuff. And she's very good at it. But you don't get the information density and complexity that you get from the letters. So it's much more Celie kind of looking out at the world more passively, when in the book you see there's a lot going on. She's thinking about God. She's thinking about forgiveness. She's thinking about pain. She's thinking about how to exist and how to get through it and what our own reactions to things are. And that depth is gone. And you know, this is the most common critique of a movie coming out of a book is you lose depth and complexity. And that's it just happens. It's I don't know how you would have done it unless you get a whole bunch of voiceover, which then read the book, which
yeah.
is fine, but it's very difficult to do.
Yeah, it's hard to say how that could have been done. I am impressed that they were able to, you know, kind of squeeze some of that out through Whoopi Goldberg just being mm-hmm. a great actor in the movie. But, you know, you do miss some of that. Every time they had a little snippet of the voiceover and Seeley, you know, addressing God, like, I thought that there was going to yeah. be more, and I was sort of anticipating it, maybe hopefully, but I truly don't think, like, this wasn't an audiobook. We're not gonna get that experience. So they were doing the best they could with what they had.
Yeah. Yeah, voiceovers are notoriously difficult. They can be a real crutch in a movie to give a voiceover, because, like, if you are that good at making movies, why do you need the people to tell what's going on? Mm-hmm. But I think for this movie, the book is essentially a voiceover of letters, essentially. I mean, that's how we're presented with the information we're given as well. Let's see, other things I have on my list. Oh, in a real... I mean, it's bad enough that the movie's nominated for 10 awards and won 0. The real gut punch is the movie that swept the Oscars that year. Did you happen to see this, Sharifa?
I had to look it up.
Yeah. Out of Africa.
Yeah.
Tough. Very tough. A movie about white people in Africa sweeping it. And I, frankly, I like Out of Africa, but as a contrast, as the one to sweep the awards with Color Purple on the board, was it the best movie of the year? Probably not. Were some of the acting awards deserving? Absolutely. Interesting for Quincy Jones having written the score. Seems largely forgettable to me. I was listening for it while watching. It's like, oh, Quincy, is he going to do some stuff? But there's a couple places in the movie where you get Suge performing or gospel mm-hmm. singing in the church, which is great, and maybe he did that. My least favorite addition, I think, is Suge coming to church with the juke joint band and asking for her father's acceptance. I thought it was cool in the book that she didn't need it. That's me.
Yeah.
She needed to go back to church and get a hug from her dad. Screw that guy, or, you know, he can do what he wants. I am who I am. I'm a married woman now, where she's like plaintively looking at him with a wedding ring. I was like, that ain't Suge in the book. That was
I know.
My biggest reaction, to be honest with you, Sharifa. That was my biggest nope, let's say. Let's put it that way.
I felt exactly the same way. I was like, why is this necessary? Like, Suge doesn't need to be saved, and I don't know why she's also, like, is the message at the end of that scene when she comes in and there's, like, the gospel battle sort of situation, is it that, you know, her dad needs to be saved, the preacher needs to be saved? I just felt like it wasn't necessary, and I love that, I just love the pageantry of that moment, but that is about
yes.
it. Like, beyond the pageant.
It's very Music Man. It's beautiful musical stuff, but
yeah.
like in this context, I'm very... And I think there's maybe an over... Maybe the idea was to integrate the two sides of the community, the real versus the imposed structure. I don't know. Also, after a Saturday night of carousing, there's no one at that juke joint on Sunday morning, Sharifa. What are those people doing there on Sunday morning? Everyone's still hung... Anyone who was there on Saturday is hungover or in church. What
that
are they doing? They look great for Sunday morning. That was a weird... Like, what are they doing?
They drink a lot of water.
Right, what's happening? Yeah. I guess so. very strange stuff there at the end. Anything else from the movie we should say? Or from the whole thing? We need to wrap up. We've been going for a while here.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know. I think we talked about this a little. We cheated a bit when we were talking about mm-hmm. this whole episode a while ago, and I was coming at it with, like, I'm not sure also how I feel about the newer adaptation being a musical and, like, what that's all going to look
yeah.
like. But I think I have to say I am actually excited about a musical adaptation of this movie. I'm also, like, I think that this adaptation paved the way for more adaptations by different people,
yes.
and that the director mm-hmm. Blitz Bazaoule is Ghanaian is really interesting to me also, because I can't speak to how, like, Africa is represented in the book or the film.
No idea. Great point.
Yeah, so I'm curious about how that's going to look, and I'm excited that there's another adaptation that'll sort of take it to a new place and, you know, do the thing of having a black director behind it.
Yeah. And you have a note here that they're going to be a little magical realist forward, which yeah. I hadn't really thought about too much, but then I read the copy of the book I read. I did an ebook version, and the one you can get from most places that's distributed by Open Road is a 30th anniversary edition, I believe, and it has two introductions. There's Alice Walker's like 10-year introduction, and then also the 30-year introduction. So it's kind of interesting to read those side by side. And her principal grievance or point or whatever she's trying to make there is how over time people have decentralized the spiritual journey of Sela, of like thinking of God as the white bearded, you know, kind of, you know, I'll call Methodist God that I grew up with, I'll say that, mm-hmm. to a more like almost Whitman-esque transcendental God is in the details, God is everywhere, it's everything, it's just being alive kind of stuff that happens at the end. And her insistence on that being the central message, because, you know, as we say, it's in the movie, it's Whoopi and Oprah. And I think in the movie, it's black gay representation are the two or three kind of like big epistemological chunks that people take. And Alice Walker is saying, like, don't forget the spirituality stuff. Don't forget the spirituality stuff. So that's interesting to see that brought forward too. I think also the musical form, also you get to have music, which is fun. But the kind of like, I don't know, artistic conceit of musicals is songs where people are just talking about what they're thinking and feelings in song.
Oh, yeah.
Which maybe is a way around, which is kind of a way around that voiceover letter problem. Sela can have a song that's to herself that's expressed in a way that's native to the genre without feeling weird or imported or, you know, compromised in some way. So
I hadn't thought of that.
It opens up some interesting opportunities as well. All right. That's The Color Purple. An amazing, revolutionary, fraught, and enduring work. I think we can say that for sure. Sharifa, thank you so much for joining me on this journey.
Yeah.
And we'll talk to you next time.